seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Welcome along, Golf Weekly friends. It's a quiet-ish time of the year, but we have reconvened for the European Tour finale, the DP World Tour Championship in Dubai. Don't worry, European Tour, unlike some people, we'll never abandon you. Nathan Murphy here in studio.
Wow.
And Fionn Davenport, fresh home from India, I think. Hello, Fionn.
Hey, lads. How's it going?
Very well. How was the trip?
Yeah, it was very good, thank you. Yeah, I was... Yeah, it was first time in India, and it was amazing. Although I inadvertently shared a hotel on the same day in Mumbai with one failed presidential candidate, Peter Casey.
Wow. How did that go?
Yeah.
That's Irish really, presidential candidate for our American listeners.
Well, so unbeknownst to me, so I'd taken a photograph from the roof of the hotel or the bar at the top, and then someone... A Golf Weekly listener had tweeted me, goes, oh, are you there with Peter Casey? And had screen grabbed the same photograph that Peter Casey had taken from the same spot. And his tweet said something to the effect of, oh, brilliant to be back in one of my favorite places, blah, blah, blah. Off to play golf for the afternoon. So, yeah. But I did see him in the hotel the next day, but I didn't talk to him.
Fionn, you don't need to be ashamed of your close friendship with Peter Casey.
I know.
Did you share a room, Fionn?
A suite, Nathan, a suite.
Oh, very nice.
Speaking of politicians, Fionn, can I ask about Douglas Dillon and his legacy and what exactly Douglas Dillon's legacy is?
Okay, first of all, I'm going to say, who's Douglas Dillon?
Well, maybe you should look right behind you, Fionn.
Oh, the Douglas Dillon legacy. Oh, yeah. Now, isn't he a politician? What are you talking about? Isn't he some art curator guy?
Is he?
I bought that poster in a museum like 20 years ago.
It's obviously very important to you.
I know. I was going to say, obviously, very close to my heart. You know?
Yeah. So India gets the two thumbs up. It's one of those places I feel like really, given that, you know, life is short and we don't stay around forever, I should go and visit somewhere like India. But I suspect I never will.
Do you know, it's a funny one. So, yeah, I've waited my whole life to go to India. And years ago, I never really had like a big, big, strong resolve. For me, it was always of those kind of big, big countries. I was always more interested in China. And but when I only spent a few days in Mumbai, but I think it's one of the most amazing cities I've ever been to. It's like New York on steroids. It's unbelievably and not at all what I mean, of course, it has all the elements that we think, you know, 22 million people, kind of chaos, huge slums and all the rest of it. But so much more than that. You know, it's a very, very interesting place.
Yeah, you see, I suspect the chaos kind of puts me off more.
Yeah, you see, I thought when you were saying that life is short and there's lots of places to go to, India will probably be at the bottom of the list.
Yeah.
I'm the sort of person who gets a dodgy belly when they arrive in Spain. So Delhi belly would just put me.
Oh, I got the Delhi belly, but I got it on the way home. I got it in the lounge at the airport.
Great.
Coming home.
I'd say you were a man who was looking at the seatbelt sign very closely for the next 20 years.
I tell you, lads.
Turn it off!
Not fun. Fun.
So, I mean, it's not fun. I mean, I presume there's a queue outside the toilet and you have to shamefully exit and apologise.
It was a night flight. Yeah, it was a night flight. So it was like while everyone else was sleeping away, I was kind of up and down. Anyway, look, I'm sure the listeners don't really
Why doesn't
know.
That make your Instagram, for God's sake? Come on.
Yeah, I tell you. Ugh, grim.
So later on, we have an interesting guest on the show. Dylan Byrne is going to pop in later on. He's one of the guys behind the 15th Club. And if that rings a bell, they provided the key statistics for Thomas Bjorn's Ryder Cup team. They did it for Darren Clarke as well at Hazeltine. Danny Willett, when he won the Masters in 2016, paid tribute to them. They've worked with McIlroy, Matt Fitzpatrick, Thomas Peters. They're now partners with the European Tour, so every tour pro can get access to their software and their app. And this company was formed just a few years ago. They now have a team of 10. They have a WhatsApp group as well. Not quite a WhatsApp group, but you can, if you're a pro on tour, get in touch with them and ask them, with regard to my schedule, what's the best course for me coming up over the next while? So they're really transforming the way professionals are going about their business. So
Dylan is a quantitative analyst. So, Joe, without question, you're going to be the most stupid person on this podcast.
I deserved that. I had a real low moment on Sunday, which I don't need to revisit.
No.
No, what was it?
Well, Nathan's doing a panel, and the panel is just full of like professors and doctors. They're talking about cutting weight in sport. And I was trying to make a quip, you know, along the lines of, Nathan, what's your...
doctorate in.
Yes. And instead, it came out, I was quite tired, it wasn't my best moment. I was like, Nathan, you're probably the most stupid person on that panel. And I could just almost hear the resentment through Nathan's voice down the line. And he still hasn't let it go. Which is a real sign of lack of intelligence, if you ask me.
Actually, oddly enough, Nathan, in India, I was there, like there was a group of journalists, and one of them was one of the sports editors for the Scotsman in Edinburgh. And I tell you, he reminded me so much of you. His name is Mark Atkinson.
Let me write that down.
Like, you know, guy with a beard, like, you know, really guy with a good beard. Fun. No, but seriously, there were moments where maybe I was tired or jet lagged, where there were moments where I went, Mark.
No,
like, honest to goodness, yeah, it was that.
Beyond the beard?
It's just a kind of a, yeah, general kind of cuddly bear kind of. You know, no, he love of sports. He just, yeah, it was weird. He just.
John is trying desperately not to dig himself a hole here.
No. He's a lovely guy. Really nice guy.
I'll take it as a compliment.
Off the ball, listeners.
Yeah, it was a compliment.
I will make a point in the meeting over the next couple of weeks of finding some Scottish story and suggesting Mark Atkinson as the guest just to see what he's like. And I look forward to that.
Anyway.
So some tweets then. We'll get into a few bits and bobs. We have Lee Westwood talking about the split with Billy Foster. Francesco Molinari is fighting it out with Tommy Fleetwood for the Tour Championship in Dubai. And then Rory McIlroy, of course. So it seems like there is a chance, though not confirmed yet, that McIlroy may not play in the Irish Open next year.
And well, it's a very strong chance, isn't
it? Yeah, there is. We threw out some tweets. Groge says, you'd expect him to prioritise it, lads. His decision, probably a reflection that Ireland is no longer a home for him. A week in Ireland puts him out as much as anywhere else. Thomas Goodall then, because the Golf Weekly tweet asked for thoughts on McIlroy not playing the Irish Open, said, that's a particularly stupid tweet. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to see him play at the weekend.
Well, very good.
Very good, very good. Bradley says, probably just playing where he's contractually obliged to outside of the majors. I don't think he's too interested anymore. The field is too deep these days. 30, 40 guys come in majors. He was billed as the next Tiger, but now he's just one of many in a golden generation. Barry Cotter, 2019 is the last year of the decade. He's up against Spieth for player of the decade. Rory has four majors, Spieth has three. One more would seal his status as the best player of the last 10 years. It's a big year for him. The schedule change has probably forced his hand. Willie Hickey, one of several who's had lads. At the end of the day, just very disappointing if he does not play in the Irish Open. That's a general sense of what people are saying. Mm. I must say I was quite surprised with the McIlroy thing, Fionn.
I mean, okay. So I tend to agree with the general thrust of the tweets. But, okay. The main reason, certainly if he doesn't play, it's because he said that he won four majors playing the week before. And so he wants to put
three of the four
playing the week before. He wants to give himself the best chance, which means that the week before the Open in Portrush, it will be the Scottish Open, and which will preclude him because he says he's only going to play two events next year. Also, as well is that I think, and I know maybe you weren't expecting this from me, but I think he deserves a pass in terms of. He has given more to the Irish Open than any single golfer of the contemporary age. He has put the Irish Open on the contemporary golf map. Without it, it wouldn't be part of the Rolex series. His term as the sponsor, as the main sponsor of the event, is over. I don't know. I have no problems. I think there's a much broader issue, though. I think even though his logic for not taking up his European Tour card kind of makes sense. You're like, well, it's not a Ryder Cup year. I think this is a blow to the Ryder Cup.
No, for sure. So it's a blow to Paul McGinley potentially as well. McGinley was writing on the Sky Sports website and he said, it's quite extraordinary that Rory's not going to play just two more events to fulfill his European Tour membership next season. I've been racking my brains. I've been wondering how that can be. Obviously, Rory sees it other ways. He's got his own rationale. But I find it very hard to understand. Says, of the 12 players that represented Europe in the Ryder Cup this year, Rory is the only one who's going to do that. And the others have all signed up to play the minimum of just four events outside the majors and WGCs. I mean, in the Paul Casey era, it is quite easy to keep your tour card if you're an elite player. And the thing which kind of jumped out at me, I hadn't realised this rule. So this is as of January 2017. And this is from the Ryder Cup Committee, the European Tour Committee. The committee has introduced a new regulation stating that players cannot be a European Ryder Cup captain or vice captain if they decline membership of the European Tour or fail to fulfil their minimum event obligation in any season from 2018 onwards. So, the logical conclusion would be if McIlroy does not play these four events in Europe next year, it would preclude him, as things stand, from ever becoming a Ryder Cup captain or vice captain. Now, that rule can be changed, of course, to make an exception, but
it's simply not going to happen. That the biggest star the European Tour has had since Seve is not going to get the captain the Ryder Cup in 2036 at Congressional, because he skipped one season.
Yeah,
maybe
I agree.
Maybe relations break down even further over the next decade and something happens there, but as a one-off, I don't see that happening. McGinley must be pissed off if Rory decides not to come. It's not quite there yet. Rory kind of, my sense of what happened is that he tied himself up in knots almost in that. He came out and said, I'm only going to play two tournaments. What'll they be? Well, I have to play the Omega tournament. Is it in France?
Yes,
this year?
Because
I'm not going to Dubai and they're my sponsors. And then, you know, I don't know what the other tournament will be, but I want to play the week before every major, which suddenly means, well, the other one must be
the Scottish Open.
Maybe right now he's not 100% sure and he's lowering expectations so that when he does come, everyone's happy to see him.
Yeah.
That's very optimistic of you, Nathan.
Possibly. I don't get this belief that's out there of he owes the European Tour or he owes the Irish Open. I just don't believe in professional sport anybody owes anything. The best rise to the top. It's simple as that. On a personal level, it's different, though, as to does he owe McGinley just as a fellow Irishman to turn up at his national tournament? He is the biggest star. I think next year's Irish Open will be just fine. It's in a brilliant venue down in Lahinch.
Yeah.
It'll sell out. They'll get some decent names because of the way the calendar is. But long term, Rory is the superstar. You're getting one of the 10 most marketable sports people in the world? For free.
But if you I agree with you, Nathan, but I think if you broaden it out, and of course as Irish, we're concerned about the future health of our national open, and so we should be. But like, I mean, European golf is in big, big trouble. Paul McGinley is not just a representative of Irish golf. He is, you know, he's a spokesperson for the European Tour. He's wedded to that. He's part of all these kind of structural committees, et cetera, et cetera. The European Tour is in big trouble, I think. I think the European Tour needs the Ryder Cup way more than it's willing to admit. I think the health of the European Tour is entirely dependent on the Ryder Cup and on nothing else. In a way that, like the PGA couldn't care less about the Ryder Cup. It doesn't need the Ryder Cup to thrive, to survive, or anything like that. You haven't mentioned it yet, but like I was really incensed by Harrington's comments about the European Tour introducing a Saudi Arabia event. And I think it's all part of the same problem. I don't know if you want to address this now.
Shoot.
Okay, so for anyone who doesn't know, the European Tour was scheduled last February. They're introducing a new event in Saudi Arabia, which is going to be in the Race to Dubai. It's a little bit, they were a bit unlucky because Jamal Khashoggi gets killed in the Saudi embassy in Turkey, which all of a sudden puts a huge focus on Saudi Arabia and its breach of human rights, so on and so forth, and also kind of adds renewed questions over Saudi Arabia's behavior in Yemen. Okay. Harrington is asked. Now, in fairness, he's kind of, it was like a hot take. You know, he was given like an off the cuff question, and I have the comment here, and where he says it's not a black or white question or answer. This is whether the tour's move into Saudi Arabia will help or not in influencing society. This idea that bringing this new event to Saudi will help with the gradual liberalization of Saudi society. And then he says, let's hope we are, you know, that we're going to bring, you know, the wind of change brought by the European Tour. Now, you know, golf is not really known for bringing any kind of liberal change to anything. Yeah. But I thought it was a very silly answer by Harrington. And even though I don't hold Harrington personally responsible for this, Roger Federer, there was a scheduled match between Nadal and Djokovic, which has since been cancelled. They've pulled out. Roger Federer came out with a statement. He goes, I made this decision very quickly not to go. And then in that same time for Harrington to say, well, you know, it's not a black or white thing. It's like, well, it actually is a black or white thing in moral terms. But what it isn't a black or white thing is in money terms. When you consider that Tommy Fleetwood, who is the main sponsor of the British Masters, they don't have a title sponsor. I'm sure Keith Pelley would love nothing more than to say, we're not going to touch Saudi Arabia with a barge pole.
Yeah.
His hand is forced. But then you have to ask yourself the question is, it's like, well, is that what it is? It comes down to money. So like ethics goes out the window, any kind of moral code, because your moral code is only, you only know if you have a moral code when it's tested. You know, it's easy to have a moral code when it's not tested. So does the European Tour, like Tiger Woods has even said, well, I'm not going to play in Saudi Arabia, which you can say, well, he doesn't have to play in Saudi Arabia. Yes. It's an easy win for him. So this is the big issue. It's like, you know, like all of a sudden, so where does the line get drawn, you know? Now, and I will say this, we can also say there's an element of hypocrisy about my attitude as well, because certainly we've ignored Abu Dhabi for a long, long time, and Abu Dhabi's behavior in Yemen is reprehensible to the point of criminality. So, you know, but it just seems to me like this is just bad, bad, bad all around for golf. And I think Harrington, I think, would have been better served, given that he knew this event was happening for months, would have been better served to come up with a better answer. I think this is a guy who's one of the great ambassadors of Irish sports, one of the most intelligent and articulate sports persons, never mind in golf, just in generally in sport. And I think he really did himself a huge disservice in making the statement the way he did. But I think it's all part of a bigger issue.
There is the possibility that Paul Harrington had thought about what he was going to say. And Harrington, I think maybe what he was saying was that you talk about a moral code. Where does your moral code begin and end?
Look at where
they play golf throughout the world. Have you played golf in Morocco, Fionn, where they drain the water from the farmers for miles around and make their lives hell so that they can have the most pristine course in the world that is played by 100 people a year?
I can confirm he has, because I was with him.
So, but that's what I mean. So what's the level that...
But there is relative. Relativity is important, Nathan. Saudi Arabia is one of the most oppressive states in the world. By any measurable standard, women don't have any rights that we recognize in the West as being equitable in any way. They have literally recently been granted the right to drive.
Yeah.
There's religious squads that go around, and any kind of misbehavior is treated with arrest, with beatings on the street. They summarily execute people. And you know, I'm certainly not saying that Saudi Arabia is the only nasty place in the world, but like by any measurable standard, Saudi Arabia is very, very low down on the list.
But by not turning up in Saudi Arabia, if Harrington made a decision, and who knows, maybe he does make a decision and says, I'm not going to go and play that tournament, it's simply not worth the hassle. It's probably the main reason at this stage for not going. But if he doesn't play in Saudi Arabia and he does play in Qatar, or even if he just plays 25 events in America where there's a lot of things happening that people aren't happy about, does that mean he's approving of things that happen there?
I don't for a second suggest that Padraig Harrington approves of anything that goes on in Saudi Arabia. That would be enormously wrong and unfair to Padraig Harrington. I just mean is that whether he likes it or not, Padraig Harrington is a spokesperson and ambassador for this sport or for the European Tour. And so he would have been better advised to come up with a better answer. However, the point I'm also trying to make is that Harrington and the European Tour are in an economically unenviable position in that Saudi Arabia is one of those shitty decisions they have to make. If that is the question, I don't think us three, I don't think we're remiss in asking uncomfortable questions. Is that like if... I don't know the answer. Well, I don't know the answer, but I think we need to ask the question.
Well, clearly they would think it is. You know, there is a point.
Sure.
Even the discussion we're trying to have here is quite nuanced. You know, you're asking, where does the pragmatism kick in? Where do you draw the line? Should we have enjoyed the Masters for the last 30, 40 years?
Well, we've been moaning about the Masters for a long time.
Sure, and we can moan about this as well. Also, to what extent does it really legitimize a country? Does anyone not think Saudi Arabia is a basket case now because there's a golf tournament there?
Okay, you're absolutely right. Golf won't make a blind bit of difference. So to Saudi Arabia, one way or the other. Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman is not going to change one iota of anything related to how he governs the country based on whether the European Tour bring an event there or not.
Yeah.
That is absolutely true. However, golf is tone deaf. Like, even NASCAR, the most Republican of sports in the United States, took a stance against the Confederate flag last year. Mm. Now, NASCAR fans rejected it outright, but it doesn't matter. It's that NASCAR, the Association of NASCAR, felt obliged to take a stand on a matter of geopolitical importance, certainly within the context of the United States. Golf is almost remarkable for its failure, and I don't buy for one second that Padraig Harrington can get away with saying something by going, hey, listen, I'm just a guy who hits a golf ball. I don't know what goes on. I'm like, dude, read a newspaper, watch the news. Everybody knows that Saudi Arabia is a shitty country. However, it is also said that golf alone isn't wrong in this. Like, Britain sells arms to Saudi Arabia all the time. France sells arms to Saudi Arabia all the time. So is golf then kind of complicit in a much broader sense the way everybody else is? We like to say, oh my God, Saudi Arabia is so wrong, but here, let's do deals with Saudi Arabia, which is effectively what the European Tour is doing. The point I was making all along was this. The timing of it is awful. I don't have a vested interest in the European Tour, but I love golf and I watch golf all the time. And I think I would be remiss in my little role as a participant in this golf podcast not to raise the question. I don't have the answer for the question, but I think it's worth raising.
The question is fine. I mean, the Harrington thing is a relatively minor point in the broad scheme of things. And maybe when he gets But when he gets a chance maybe to talk about it in a bit more depth, and you don't know how much he thought about it in advance. I don't know, was this a media scrum? Or was this a sit-down thing where he had time to prepare?
He was asked on the hoof.
You know, I think anyone being asked on the hoof cannot put forward their best self.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. And the other point to make is that look, it's very simple. It's just about money. That's all it is about. You know, so, like, I mean, we're kind of asking quite broad philosophical questions.
I would say it's
just purely about money.
So you're dead right. It is about money, and Saudi Arabia will be a very worthwhile venture for the European Tour in a money sense.
Yeah.
In a very difficult time. So, and part of the new
season. Sorry to interrupt. They know it's a very difficult time. Mm. Like, the PR release, which announced all the venues for the season ahead, you know, made a big point of celebrating. There's a new tournament somewhere in North Africa, potentially. Was it Kenya?
They've promoted it. It was a Challenge Tour event for a long, long time, and it's been lifted up to full European Tour status.
So Malachy Clerken wrote about the press release itself, and they gave a big warm welcome to Kenya on the press release. But in the entire press release outlining all the events ahead, there was no mention of Saudi Arabia. So it's fairly obvious. I mean, what you can read into that is fairly obvious. We know this stinks. We know nobody likes this. In truth, we're probably not very proud of ourselves here, but this is just raw capitalist pragmatism.
I think you're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
The question is
actually, to what extent do you lambaste them for it? And I don't, like, I mean, why do we, how do you, what's the metric here?
Well,
10 out of 10 lambasting?
Fionn started off by saying European Tour, and then you moved to golf about being tone deaf. And I think it is a golf issue because, all right, so the European Tour right now has huge problems. And I would suspect in 5-10 years, the European Tour is going to be a totally different thing. Mm. So the French Open, no longer a Rolex Series event. The world number one not playing at their season-ending tournament in Dubai. These are issues that are getting bigger and bigger, as we hear from McIlroy this week.
Yeah.
The end scenario is potentially that we end up with a world tour run by some sort of a combination of 70% PGA Tour, 30% European Tour.
Mm.
Whatever it is, golf is going to go to Saudi Arabia because that's where the money is.
Sure.
Doesn't matter who's running it. They're going to go. In fact, I'd say the only thing that's pissing the PGA Tour off is that they have this sort of gentlemanly agreement that they won't go there.
Mm. Yeah, no, I totally agree. The other thing, I mean, to round it back slightly to McIlroy's decision, is that the schedule is in a total state of flux at the moment, you know?
Yeah.
If you were to sum it up in broad terms, it seems for the season ahead, the PGA Tour has front-loaded the schedule. So the early part of the year, the first half of the year, is going to have all the best stuff. And then it's the reverse for the European Tour. So the majority of the Rolex Series events, like the BMW PGA at Wentworth, is in September. The Race to Dubai, obviously, is in the second half of the year. So it's almost like a two halves of a year kind of set up between both tours, which actually would strengthen the argument that somewhere post September. McIlroy could very easily play in a decent event to make up those two tournaments.
Well, this is a whole new ball game for everybody, is part of this, I would imagine. And McGinley makes that point. So what's Rory going to do for that second? Is he just not going to play golf? Maybe actually Rory's looking at this thinking, so the new schedule is March, Players' Championship, April, Masters, May, USPGA, June, US Open, July, Open Championship, August, FedEx Cup. Maybe he's thinking, this is going to be so intense for 6 months.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm not really going to play.
Yeah.
I'm just for next year, I'm going to test the waters. I'm going to throw absolutely everything into these 6 months. It's going to be grueling. I'm going to be around the world. There's going to be the odd week off here and there. But it's going to be unlike anything we've ever gone through before. All the while trying to chase a Grand Slam and trying to hold off Jordan Spieth and Brooks Koepka, who we shouldn't forget about going for a fourth major of the decade next year.
Stop ignoring Brooks.
Jesus Christ.
What does he have to do? Does he have to win 10 majors before you might mention his name?
But maybe McIlroy right now is going, I'm not going to commit to anything after the FedEx Cup because I don't know how I feel. I could be absolutely shattered.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'm not going to make commitments to the European Tour or anybody about being at Wentworth or being anywhere after that.
Yeah, totally. Not to put anyone on the... sorry, just got to move it on a touch. Does anyone know when the Saudi Arabia tournament is on, by the way?
I'll tell you now. Hang on a second. I'm just looking at it here. It's in the Desert Swing. So it'll play January 31st.
Okay.
Yeah.
So all the big boys, a lot of the big boys will be out in the States at that stage, you know? They can dodge this one very easily.
Will they be in the California Swing by this stage?
Probably, yeah. Again, I mean, the schedule ahead is a little bit up in the air. So.
Just one final thing on Rory. For all of, we've all observed Rory's statements over the years, but, he always gives good teasers as to what's going to happen. Like, particularly in, do you remember he hummed and hawed for a long time about the Olympics? But you often wonder, when he eventually made the decision, was he not just laying out the groundwork for, look, I'm not going to be playing in the Olympics. So I'm just kind of I'm giving you a hint of it now. So I would not be surprised at all if he doesn't show up at the Irish Open or says it's not going to be part of the schedule.
No.
I think he's just warning us now.
It's true. We're going to get to a few more stories in just a second. So the European Tour finale is on. Justin Rose is dodging it, as Nathan alluded to earlier on, which is not great. So we're back in Dubai, the Greg Norman-designed Earth Course. Dubai, Fionn, bastion of human rights and good practice. Yep. Have you ever been to Dubai?
I have many times. Yeah, they're broke, so, you know.
Hypocrite.
Well, it's more... In Yemen, it's Abu Dhabi, really, that are leading the way, you know. More than Dubai. Dubai don't have a huge amount of power in any geopolitical sense. Abu Dhabi do, though.
Mm, okay.
The emirate next door.
Francesco Molinari is very much the man in pole position. I mean, you just look at the season he's had, by the way. It's worth reflecting on for a second. So he won the BMW Championship at Wentworth. He got his first PGA Tour title, the Quicken Loans. He won the Open at Carnoustie, the first European player in history to go 5-0 at the Ryder Cup. Quite ridiculous. He was saying he hasn't been back to Italy since he won the Open. Life's been just a bit crazy since then. So, in short, he needs a top five finish. Even if Tommy Fleetwood, who's a million points behind him, wins a top five finish, does it for Molinari. A few Irish lads out there. Shane Lowry's out there, obviously, and that's going to... Well, I guess it's already underway.
It is. First round is over. Jordan Smith and Adrian Otegi tie for the lead on 6-under. Danny Willett and John Rahm on 5-under par.
Okay. So we'll keep
Francesco's on 4-under, so listen, he's ticking along nicely. Tommy Fleetwood's on 3-under alongside Rory.
The next story is Justin Rose, don't do it. So he's skipping the season ending Dubai World Tour Championship in Dubai. We'll keep an eye on that this week. He's also thinking, it seems, of ending a 20-year deal with his equipment company. So it seems like he was talking to press after the Turkish Airlines Open. There was talk of a new equipment deal that he was leaving TaylorMade, and his line was, where there's smoke, there's fire. So it seems Justin is leaving TaylorMade for Japanese luxury equipment brand Hanma.
Oh, yeah. Aren't they like the most expensive clubs in the world? Or you can get a basic set costs you like $5,000.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. They're really good, apparently, though.
Oh, fair enough. Okay, because, well, then maybe it's not so bad. Hanma have recently hired the former TaylorMade president and CEO, Mark King, who seems to be on very good terms with Rose. And he's bringing over a couple of engineers as well. So it seems Rose is going to do it. But I don't know. I just always get a bit edgy when players
You're the
do
world
this.
Number one.
Don't go tinkering.
Don't change
with it.
Anything.
I know. This can. Yeah. I mean, this can slow you down for a year or two, minimum.
Oh, like this is your stereotypical, this time next year, Justin Rose is back playing in Dubai going, just don't know what happened.
Yeah.
Just took me too long to get into it.
Yeah.
Did you see, it's a bit like Brandel Chamblee tweeted about this during the week, that because Rory had tied himself, whatever to do with his contract, that he was playing a driver that he didn't like at all, but was committed to playing it for like 3 weeks in a row.
Mm.
And Chamblee rightfully said, he goes, it's kind of weird. Like, one of the best players in the world shouldn't be playing a driver that he doesn't like.
Yeah.
Like, I always find that bizarre that you would be going out with equipment that doesn't suit you.
That was actually the weirdest part of that press conference.
There is, you can explain in a second, but there is a theme emerging here. People are doing things they don't necessarily want to do.
Like for money.
And there is one reason. I mean, really. Yeah. We sound very naive here. Sorry, the press conference.
You're not sure.
Yeah. The only people not getting paid are us.
Yeah.
God, that's exactly it.
Gives us the freedom, you see, Joe.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. We can sit here on our high horse.
Well, I just thought that, because there was the comments of his tour schedule change, took all the headlines, actually, that was the most alarming part of it. Again, we get to an end of the year, and it was his driver shaft he was talking about, that he had ended up changing several occasions down through the year. And this, the one he has this week, he's really happy with.
Yeah.
Really, really happy with.
Okay.
But come January, there's going to be new shafts out, and he goes back into testing and he tries to find the right one again.
That's ludicrous. Can they not just do the old football boots trick and paint the shaft in the new colours?
I know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe he's going do that.
But I can't wait for all the really good stuff that's coming out.
Yeah, that's ludicrous. I mean, I think it's tough on players because the equipment, obviously for money, again, Fionn, they just keep making new versions of the same brand and it's quite tough on players.
I also, as well, and this is where I am 100% admitting to my naivete, it's like, how difficult is it to get a set of clubs that suits a professional golfer?
Yeah.
Like, they have all the research, all the resources, all the money, all the testing, just, like,
it's
what's
true.
The big...
It's true.
You know what I mean?
Last point then, because we've got to wrap this up, we're moving on. Lee Westwood and Matt Kuchar.
Ooh, yeah.
Did you see this? It was the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
Matt Kuchar and Lee Westwood.
Yes.
Both winning for the first time in 4 years, but the last time they was exactly the same day. April 20th, 4 years ago.
Freaky.
Absolutely incredible. What does that tell you? Is there some biorhythm theory that you want to throw out there, Fionn?
No.
Okay.
Did you watch it, though? He was so impressive. Well, I watched Westwood. He was brilliant.
Yeah. He says he's been trying to integrate a new process, a pre-swing process, and it's paying dividends.
Looking at his girlfriend on the bag? Is that the... Because he was unbelievable. It was the best I've seen him play for a long, long time.
So Helen Story is the girlfriend. She was in the bag.
Yeah.
And he was talking about his split with Billy Foster. I mean, they were one of the real reliable partnerships.
10 years.
Anton
Deck. 11 years.
Anton Deck.
They were at the Anton Deck. It was an interesting one, though, because he made a joke at the end of the Ned Bank, didn't he say, he goes, well, maybe, you know, because he had his girlfriend on the bag, and he goes, geez, you know, I've had a win, or sorry, I came second, whatever it is, good finish, and then a win with her in the bag. So maybe I should get rid of, you know, he made this kind of weird joke. And then sure enough, 5 days later, he's gone.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is, did you see the matter of fact way it was announced? Like, so he says to him, he goes, yeah, it's not working. Yeah. I'm not winning with you on the bag. And Billy Foster says, yeah, but I can't caddy for you the way I want to caddy for you.
Yeah,
and basically, he had just become a bag carrier.
Mm.
Yeah, go on, sorry.
Well, so he talks about winning with Helen Story in the bag. He's going to have Glenn Murray in the bag this week.
Yeah,
and Foster, no, I don't think so. Foster,
Sergio, who won the Masters with Sergio, Glenn Murray did.
Okay, so he's going to have Glenn Murray this week, and then Foster's going to work with Matt Fitzpatrick this week. Say Foster will be a man in demand potentially.
Oh, well, who was he linked with straight away?
Rory, yeah. So he talked about meeting Billy Foster over in Dubai this week after the win last week. He said, obviously, we're very good friends. I saw him there earlier. We had a big hug. He said, well done. He was crying. And I thought, wow. But then it was actually a joke, as Westwood said. He was crying. He forgot to back me. Mine and Billy's working relationship has got to the point where neither of us were gaining anything from it. We weren't doing each other any good. I sat him down. I said, this is no good. I'm playing better when you're not here.
Look.
Okay, tell me what you really think. This is no good. Yeah. I'm playing better when you're not really here. So something is obviously not working. And he said, well, I can't caddy for you how I want to caddy. And Westwood said, I don't require that much from a caddy anymore. I've been out here a long time. I'm 45 years of age. And Billy has obviously been out here for years as well. And he's very knowledgeable. And so he wants to use all that knowledge to help somebody. And I couldn't see he wasn't happy doing that. So it was just one of those things where it had come to an end. So that would make me think Rory will hear that and say, yeah, you're not using all that knowledge on me either, Billy. Rory doesn't want someone on his bag dominating him. So I wouldn't think that'll happen. So it looks good to see Westwood win. He's very emotional in the interview with Tim Barter afterwards. I don't know if you saw that.
I thought it was great. It's beautiful. And also as well, it's given that he beat Sergio Garcia, who's the overnight leader, but he's just, like, Garcia shot a 70. It was fine. Like, he played okay. Mm. But, like, did you see, like, he had eagle the second, Westwood, but it's the back nine. Five birdies in the back nine. Lad was on fire, he was.
It is very impressive. Any final thoughts as we say goodbye to you?
No, I have to say. It's been a while since I've been on the pod, and I'm glad. I've missed it.
Well, it was nice having you back on. Don't visit Saudi Arabia. That's the big takeaway from this podcast.
Oh, it's going to be the highlight of my week if in a fortnight Fiona's on Instagram in Saudi Arabia giving it the big thumbs up.
It's my job.
It's almost impossible to visit Saudi Arabia. Like, you can get a business visa if you're doing business in Riyadh, but the interesting places to visit, you can't visit it as a non-Muslim because of the Hajj, because they're the holy cities.
Is that right?
You can't, as a non-Muslim, it's a weird, I mean, yes, you can go to Riyadh on business, you know, and lots of people do, but it's not really lent towards non-Islamic tourism.
Okay. As ever, your knowledge of the world puts us to shame quite severely. Fionn Davenport, thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Cheers, lads.
That's Fionn. Up next, we are getting into the world of golf statistics. So we're joined in studio, I'm delighted to say, by Dylan Byrne, who's an analyst with the 15th Club. Dylan, you're very welcome.
Thanks.
What do you think of golf going to Saudi Arabia? No, you're very welcome. So you're an analyst with the 15th Club. I was mentioning at the top of the show a bit about the 15th Club and the work that you've done. It seems to be a massive success. Partners with the Ryder Cup teams now, the European Tour. And this is the cutting edge of what the players are looking at now, their stats, basically. And that's where you guys come in.
Yeah, more or less. I think kind of worldwide, every player wants to get any sort of an edge they can get. So, you know, whether it's a team or a company or player specific, you know, everybody wants to get that extra couple of percent. And at the top level, the really elite level, that's the big difference between players.
I was reading an interview where the 15th Club started a few years ago. Darren Clark really got on board and used the service for Hazeltine, and Thomas Bjorn has continued that. So what kind of stuff are you giving Thomas Bjorn?
It started really early in the process, so like you kind of varied obviously as it went through the process, but we were giving him varied a lot. So right at the start it was kind of some information on how we would structure the qualification process or how we would structure his picks. So things like the picks, obviously historically the captain's picks have performed slightly better than qualifiers at the end of the qualification. So the idea there is that obviously give him as many picks as he can, because that'll increase the performance of the team as a whole. And then going on from there, there's an online tool that was developed. It's called Captain, funny enough. And he can log into that and he can see kind of how each player is performing and see their schedule, their upcoming schedule and things like that. So that was a lot of kind of the useful tools that he had going through the process. One of the key things there was probably that he could see a percentage chance of each player qualifying. So, you know, he could see quite early, I think last October, Tyrrell Hatton was about 95% to be in the team.
Okay.
So that gives him an opportunity to start talking to him and start preparing him for, you know, he's basically going to be there.
And how did you work that out? Was it simply that he had so many points at that stage it was going to be impossible? Were you predicting how many more points he was going to win?
Yeah, to a point, yeah. We put a pretty good guess in it, but it kind of varies with his schedule and things like that as well. But yeah, you can get a reasonably good estimate of how many points he'll get, and then that's how you end up with the percentage, you know, rather than saying once they get over like what we predict is the threshold, we'd say they're 100%. But it's predicting their schedule, and then so there's a bit of variability in it, but it's generally pretty accurate. I mean, 3 months out, just before the Italian Open, we had 7 of the final 8 qualifiers as, I think, over 70%. So that was, again, that was pretty key for Thomas to be able to say, you know, he can start bringing the team together and start saying, look, this is the likely team. This is also the likely players who will probably need a pick. So we had, like, Garcia was, I think, about 15% to qualify at that stage. So, you know, it puts him in a position where he can say, these guys are probably going to need a pick. So, you know, we need to look at them from that angle rather than the chances they'll actually qualify.
So from what Joe's saying, it wasn't your first Ryder Cup then, having worked, done some work with Clark at Hazeltine.
Well, it was my first Ryder Cup.
It was your first Ryder Cup. But for the company then, how does that process work with Bjorn? Do the European Tour approach the company and say, we want this statistics-based approach to be available to Bjorn? Does he have to use it?
No.
How does that whole dynamic work?
As far as I know, it was kind of a combined thing. So we have the relationship with the European Tour through kind of providing a platform for calculating strokes gained. But, you know, the kind of, there's constant contact over and back there. But I think, as far as I know, the option is laid out to Thomas. You know, does he want to use us and how much he wants to use us? And then, luckily enough, he was happy to kind of go ahead with it. And I think he used it really well, you know, through the whole process, because the key to kind of our success and our kind of usefulness to the team is that he knows the right questions to ask and kind of how to merge the technical pure science part of it and then the kind of the softer elements of it, so the personalities and the style of play. So to be fair, full credit to Thomas for that, because he managed that excellently through.
Because the Sergio pick struck me as maybe it must have been a combination of the numbers and also Sergio's record and relationship with the Ryder Cup. Were his numbers terrible?
No. I mean, what we said, like, we kind of put forward all the information for all kind of those seven or eight players really in contention for the picks. What we effectively said was that it's not the make or break of the Ryder Cup. You know, if you pick Matt Wallace or if you pick Sergio or if you pick Rafa or whoever, you know, you can pick any of these guys and it's not going to be, like, Sergio wasn't, he was marginally behind in certain areas and he was marginally ahead in certain areas. And at that level, like I said earlier, at that level, the kind of percentage difference between, like, say, being ranked 30th and ranked 40th is really small.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can put them into a match with anybody, as you know, as you say with Sergio, put them in a match with anybody and they can beat them. Mm. So what we kind of said was, look, this is all the information kind of from our point of view. Pick whoever you think is going to suit the team best and, you know, whoever you want on the team, because at the end of the day, that's the most important thing.
And in general terms then, so you're trying to measure this game statistically and it hasn't really been done for the vast majority of the game's history.
Yeah.
And therefore, there are lots of maxims like drive for show, put for dough. Mm. So what are the statistics saying about the most important aspects of the game? You know, if you were going out, based on what you know about statistics, if you could transform one aspect of your game, I'm wondering what would it be? What statistically is proving to be a real guide towards who will win a tournament?
It's off the tee, really.
Is it?
Yeah. That's the be all and end all. And that's developed over time. So we're doing a little piece of work at the minute where we're kind of looking at how distance and driving has, I suppose, evolved over the past kind of 25 years in the game. And distance is now, so off the tee has always historically been very important. Mm. But distance is now becoming more important than accuracy. So a guy who can hit it, like, you know, 320 yards, like Rory can, on average, is just going to be, he's going to be gaining so many strokes on the field. Even if he's bang average accuracy, he's going to be gaining more strokes in the field than he would do in other areas where he was.
Right.
Like, if you look at the top end of the strokes gained off the tee versus the top end of strokes gained on approach, the strokes gained approach guys are good, but they're not like the elite.
Right.
You know, whereas strokes gained off the tee is like DJ, Rory, John Rahm, you know, they're all Tommy Fleetwood's fifth. You know, you have, that's where they make their
interesting
make their gains. And
is that because a lot of the courses now, especially on the PGA Tour, let you get away with errant drives as well?
Yeah, that's an element of it, yeah. That was something we looked at after the Ryder Cup, because there was kind of that narrative around, you know, why did Europe perform so much better? And there's something in that, because Le Golf National had narrower fairways than the majority of American courses, but it also had more penal rough, whereas, you know, significantly more penal rough, like you're talking 40% more, so it was like a half-stroke penalty if you went in the rough, as opposed to, like, the worst in the Europe, or the PGA Tour is like 0.35.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's what you're talking about, the scoring difference between a guy who hits it in the rough as opposed to in the fairway. So, yeah, definitely PGA Tour, wider fairways, less penal rough, but You know, you look at Cameron Champ there. I mean, the rest of his game is good, but his driving is just so incredible. And, you know, that's going to serve him well over the next who knows how long.
Yeah.
And well, what happened then at Le Golf National? And obviously Mickelson's comments afterwards that basically there's no point in playing a course like that because he simply can't find the fairway. Was your involvement that deep that you could point out to Thomas Bjorn the real strong benefits of going with extreme rough, the most difficult course? You probably, the way it played that week, would have been the most difficult course on the European Tour that year.
Yeah, it was. Well, it actually was for the French Open as well. It has the most penal rough on the European Tour generally. We did do a lot of work on it. So this year was the first year we got like shot level data for the French Open, which is huge for us. So kind of immediately after that, we sent them a summarised report of, I suppose, the key requirements to be successful around that course. And the main one really was finding the fairway and hitting a decent distance. It's not just about, like, you know, hitting. You can't just hit a 6-iron on, off the tee and find the fairway. You have to get it out there as well. So, yeah, that was one of the things we did. I don't think, in general, the course setup was actually changed as much as people think for the Ryder Cup. I mean, like, the French Open setup is not, and even the numbers afterwards, the numbers aren't that different to how they were for the French Open. It's just that's what the course is. We were actually over there on the Tuesday of the French Open, and we kind of walked the course, and I remember even thinking at the time, you have like the sixth, like the fairway looks so narrow. I'm sure you've seen it. Like, yeah. It's like the width of this room, you know, it's like 17 yards wide, I think, at the landing area. So, yeah, that was the same at the French Open. So I think the kind of impact of the captains messing around with the course really was probably overrated a little bit at the Ryder Cup, but there's no doubt that the course, you know, initially played into the Europeans' hands anyway. That was kind of one of the things we had modelled before the event, was that, you know, how well would each player and I suppose specifically each pick as well,
yeah,
how well they would fit the course. So that was...
Yeah, something I was wondering is, with every sport there's just limitations to what you can measure, you know? And there is just almost an unquantifiable magic about certain things. Yeah. So I'm wondering if there are certain players, like I suspect Peter Lawrie, who's a regular guest on
Jordan
the show,
Spieth,
talking
yeah.
Jordan Spieth. Are there certain players who defy their statistics? Are there certain players who on paper should not be winning, and there is just some kind of a unmeasurable magic under pressure or in certain scenarios that don't make sense on paper but work out there? Are there any that jump to mind? Or actually do the stats pretty much guide you?
The stats do guide you. Sometimes it can be a little bit slow to catch up. So what you'll find is, like, we have kind of ranking systems for the players, and it can take, like, say, Cameron Champ, again, to go back to him. Like, he's not rated very highly in our model at the minute.
Right.
But he's obviously performing way beyond that, because it takes quite a lot of time for us to kind of catch up and the stats to say he's really good, because you don't want to jump into it. The obvious answer to that question is Matt Wallace. I mean, Matt Wallace, he rates highly. He's obviously one of the best players in the world, but he wins, like, to win three times the European Tour, you know, he's a winner. And that's, there is an X factor to that that you can't really, you can't define, and you kind of can't model that in, because, well, you can, but you can't, you know, accurately model it in.
It's hard to know. What category would you put it in under, even? X yeah. factor or...
Yeah, you know, yeah, you just have an adjustment.
He's won before factor, so we'll add a few points on
yeah,
it.
You listen
does
to,
that come into it?
His interview around the time of his last win went into a bit of detail on his competitiveness since yeah. he was five, 6 years of age, and how nothing but winning ever really mattered to him. Yeah. And in golf, he found that difficult, and does find it difficult, that you can't win every week, and that really a top 10 doesn't give him any sort of a buzz at all.
Yeah.
Whereas when he's in contention, that's when he comes alive.
Yeah. Well, you can see in his record, like, I mean, when he gets in contention, he has, I think coming into the Ryder Cup, he had like three top tens and they were all wins. So, like, you know, you look at that, and that doesn't tie in with the kind of general narrative of, you know, normally you'll have a guy who has like two wins,
yes.
you know, five or six top tens or whatever. But when he gets there, he wants to win, and, you know, more often than not, he does.
And you're not at the point yet where you have any kind of personality tests or metric for personality.
We don't have that. I know that exists. I know there is guys that do that, and there's a lot of players who work with kind of psychologists and, you know,
yeah.
specific coaches to kind of teach them how to win. But no, we don't.
It's
we
a difficult thing to measure, I suppose.
That's the thing, yeah.
I guess in broad terms, the other thing about measuring golf statistics is for what, maybe the last 20, 30 years, there was things like greens and regulation.
Mm.
You know, so me and Nathan are playing and we both have a green in regulation, but his shot is 2 feet from the pin and it's a stunningly good shot and he taps in. And mine is 30 feet and just inside the fringe.
Yeah.
So statistically, we've hit the same shot, but really, our approach shots have been very, very different. And this is where Strokes Gained has come in. Can you explain to two idiots basically what Strokes Gained is doing?
Yeah, it's kind of evolving, I suppose. So at the basic level, it's like what you're doing is you're taking the average number of shots it will take. So say if both of you are in the middle of the fairway, 150 yards out, you know, it'll probably take you on average, say, 3 shots to get down from there.
Yeah.
But if you put it, if Nathan puts it to 2 feet like he does, then he's on average, you know, 1 shot to get down from there. But he's taken a shot in the meantime. So he's gone from 3 to 1, but he's taken a shot. So he's gained a stroke on that shot. That's assuming he can hold a 2-footer.
Yeah.
And then, so that's that. You've gained your stroke there, and that kind of quantifies out. So if you've put it to 7 feet, then you're about 50% to make it from 7 feet. So that would put you at 1.5 strokes.
Mm.
So then you've gone from 3 to 1.5, but you've taken a shot, so you've gained half a stroke.
Mm.
Now the key kind of we're finding at the minute is that that's all very well, but how do you define your baseline of how many shots it takes you to get down from the middle of the fairway?
Mm-hmm.
So that varies a lot. So that varies from the PGA Tour to the European Tour to any of the three of us playing, you know. So that's kind of, that's really the key element. And I think that's the next level of strokes gained.
So you'll have a baseline for different courses and different players that you'll go back to year on year and you'll know what the...
No, the baseline is standard. So that's okay. Like, you know, if somebody's, you would say in theory, if you put somebody 150 yards out in the middle of the fairway, anywhere in the world,
yeah,
they should get it down in X amount overall.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why strokes gained are very important to take over a kind of a larger sample, rather than, you know, if you take somebody's single round, it can be skewed a little bit, but there's adjustments that are applied kind of week to week and round to round where if everybody's putting it to 2 feet, you know, which wouldn't happen, but if everyone was putting it to 2 feet,
yeah,
then that would suggest that the approach shots are a lot easier.
Yeah.
So then we'll adjust everybody down in line with that, okay, to kind of say, well, look, or the putting is a good example. Putting actually happens quite a lot where if you have easier greens or tougher greens, you need to adjust it back in line to say, you know, the putting's been, everyone's gaining strokes in the green, so then we need to say, well, the greens are actually pretty easy. So,
And who are you making this information available to? I'm thinking, like, bookmakers straight away. It must be like, this is gold dust.
No, we have models. We have models about predicting who's going to win tournaments and who's going to finish wherever. But
how good are they?
They're good. Yeah, they're very good. Yeah.
Who's going to win in Dubai this week?
Well, Rory's obviously the big favourite for us, you know. But right. Yeah, it picks out. Like, I mean, we do compare it to Bucky's models because they're generally very good, and they come out. You know, we're a bit ahead of them as it is.
So. Are you really? Interesting. That could be sold for a lot of money.
Yeah.
What do the stats say about Rory's putting? As a matter of interest.
Not great things. He's ranked about 290th in the world.
Is he?
Yeah, I mean that's adjusting for everything, like to adjusting for strength of field and different things that he's playing against. But yeah, about 290th, and that's out of about 420. So like it's below average, but it's not. Look, it's below average for him, but it's not kind of as awful as everyone might think either.
And did he ever have a peak year with his putting, or have you been around long enough to know that?
It was definitely better. I don't know the numbers for previous years, but okay, it was definitely better in previous years. But putting's a little bit like that, where it goes up and down. You have Jordan Spieth, you can see him, you know, he's had a couple of good years. He's dipped a little bit this year in his putting, but that's, putting is probably the most variable statistic.
Very volatile. Sometimes I go on the PGA Tour website statistics and, you know, you see someone's ranked 167th for a certain stat, say it's putting. And then you look into it and it's actually, well, he's just taken, you know, one extra putt around or something, which is kind of nothing, but they're just so bunched, it's actually incredible.
Yeah.
And you alluded to something there where you said the odds of making a putt from 7 feet are 50%.
Well, yeah.
Give or take.
Yeah.
I think amateurs, because we were at the David Pell School in Killeen Castle, and I was blown away at the percentages for professionals to make putts from certain distances. Like, we're crucifying ourselves as amateurs if we don't make a putt from 6, 7, 8 feet, we're going for, you know, 9 feet, we're saying, ah, I'm useless. Yeah. Actually, pros from more than 7, 8 feet, the odds aren't as good as we might think.
They are and they aren't, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Explain, I could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, like the average for PGA Tour.
The Pell Sky could have been just being nice to me, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, on the PGA Tour, the average is about 50% from 8 feet, kind of. It's between 7 and 8 feet.
That's not great. You know what I mean? Like 8 feet, 50%. Yeah. I mean,
there's
70.
There's other factors as well, because their greens are perfect. Like their greens are like that.
Yeah.
You know, and they have the slopes and they have the green books and everything. So you'd like to think if you've got a good top level amateur on in those circumstances and that environment, they'd be somewhere near that number as well. But
yeah.
But then you can look at kind of other numbers. There's a lot of perspective. Like if you look at Justin Rose this year, his whole 90% of his putts inside 10 feet.
Whoa.
So I mean,
whoa.
Yeah, that's
frightening.
That's PGA Tour. But like, yeah, that's the kind of numbers. It all depends on, you can frame it however you want. And that's, to be honest, a lot of what we do is taking it out of a particular frame or a particular angle and saying he's actually really good, you know, objectively speaking. Because you can, like, you could go to Justin Rose and say that to him, and he'd be like, "Oh, great, I'm really good at putting." But he is, incidentally. But you know, you could have somebody else who's hold a similar. You could have a guy who's hold 89%, and he'll be ranked like 40th.
Right.
You know, so it's all about the angle you look at it. But yeah, to go back to your original point, yeah, it's about 50% from just under 8 feet, and then it, you know, kind of drops off. It does drop off quite a lot from there.
So what's a 10-12 footer range for a pro?
10-12 footer is both. Just under 40, I think, off the top of my head.
Yeah,
but yeah, again, it varies a little bit. But
so the point is, we should not be kicking ourselves for missing 10 footers.
No, definitely not. No. I mean, amateurs would drop off a lot more than that. Like.
No kidding.
And the work you do then with individuals. Say we've just spent a good half an hour chatting about Rory and his schedule for next year.
Yeah.
Can you go through strength of field, toughness of course, toughness of greens, his putting statistics, his all-round driving statistics? And go to McIlroy and say, do you know what? The European Tour ain't no good for you, buddy. You need to play PGA Tour. You need to play these 10 events are the 10 events you are most likely to win outside of the majors.
Are you suggesting they're behind Rory McIlroy's decision to skip the Irish Open?
Well, I'm hoping that he may stumble into admitting such a thing.
What have you told Rory? Sorry.
We do that with certain players. Yeah, we do. We go through. So the kind of simplified version of it is that we have a model which will match. It's about 30 statistics on a player, and it will match those to successful players on particular courses, and it will say, it'll give us a number at the end of it. So it basically goes through the model and it'll give us back a number, and it'll say, for example, this week Rory is, I think he's just under half a stroke suited to the course, if you get me. It's probably a bad way of wording it, but he will be on average half stroke better than he normally is around Jumeirah Earth than he would around a course where he's bang average suited to. So we can then say, yeah, well, they all, you know, all those things factor in. So you have strength of field, and then you obviously have your kind of the purse for the event. But the key one for us will be how well they're suited to the course, because that's how much they will elevate their performance around that course. But yeah, we do that for the players that we
and
work with.
And do you have players who trust you to the level that if you were to come to them, say this time of the year when they're plotting out their schedule and say, I want to play 25 times, what 25 tournaments should I play? They will listen.
It goes back to the kind of same mentality that Thomas had at the Ryder Cup, was that it ties into practicality, and you know, there's a lot of other factors that are involved in it. It's, you know, whether they like the course. You know, it's all very
it's
well.
A nice week.
Yeah, it's a nice place to be. You know, it definitely ties back into that. But yeah, there's definitely players who will sit down with us and say, look, you know, I'm thinking about playing these. What do you think of that? And we kind of say, yeah, well. Maybe drop this one and add this one in, and yeah, there's players that we do that for, and it just depends on the player and how it fits. Because logistically, if we say play Mayakoba this week and then play Japan next week, they might kind of go, don't really fancy that.
And I suppose the statistics go out of kilter when they've been on a flight for
exactly
36 hours.
Yeah. There's other factors for that. So we look at, say, the World Cup in Melbourne. I had a look at that historically the players who played the WGC after that. I think that's the one. The WGC after that, they play worse coming from Australia, whereas if they come from the PGA Tour, it was the Honda Classic, I think, the week before that. But if they come from there, they play, I think it's like a quarter of a stroke better. So you can factor that in as well.
Yeah. You guys at the 15th club must sit around and think about the next 10 years. Where's all this going to go? I'm sure it's changing very quickly.
Yep.
Is there a next frontier of things that you'd like to be able to measure and will be able to measure, and ways in which stats might affect the game if we were sitting here in 10 years' time talking about where it is?
The key, to be honest, the key for us at the minute is gathering as much information as we can, because we have very good information on the PGA Tour. We're getting there with the European Tour, where we have quite a lot of, it's all about getting the shot level data, really. So we've got that for PGA. We're getting there with the European Tour. And
when you,
we'd
when
like
you say
to get,
shot level, you mean like the average kind of performance?
No, it's actual stuff. Shot by shot. So like we can say Shane Lowry on the 15th hole of whatever event took a shot from this location, this lie, this distance to this location, this lie, this distance.
Right.
And that's how we calculate strokes gained all based on that.
Okay, so you need, I mean, it doesn't make sense that you need to incorporate things like lie. Of course
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of other things you can call, like wind as well.
Wind and weather and everything, yeah. So it's actually incredibly complicated to get to compare different shots on different days, different lies, different weather.
Yeah, it is complicated, but we try and simplify it to a point that it's kind of understandable. But yeah, gathering the data for the minute and kind of going to different areas, so like going to Challenge Tour or going to the LET or different tours would be another... That's another angle we're looking at.
I guess I'm sort of asking, like, could you get to a point where, I don't know, the caddy and the player will have a massive statistical help with shot selection? They might be standing in a certain part of the course and they might be able to check something. I don't even know. I mean, devices won't be allowed, I'm sure. But, you know, some kind of thing which lets them know, actually, you're much better off hitting your six iron from here, from this lie. Like, is it going to get to that point? Maybe it's there already.
Yeah,
possible?
Well, we do a lot of that. We do pre-event packs for players.
Right.
So we'll kind of do out maybe like a 10-page report on a course for each of our players, and it'll say it's not really gone down to the level of the player specifically, but it goes to, like, you know, we might say on a drivable par 4, for example, you want to take the driver here because you'll average a quarter of a shot better or whatever, and you might want to take your 6-iron instead. So that's already there, and I probably would see a future, but it depends on the player.
You know the risk and reward when the commentator's saying this is a risk and reward hole. Actually, the player knows exactly percentage-wise what that risk and reward is.
Some of them do, yeah. Not all of them, but some of them do. And I mean...
Because I guess some of them will just be field players from the day they were born, and they're staying field players, and they look at you nerds. They look at you nerds and they say, get out of my sight, get away from me.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I mean, we're not out to kind of change any of that. I mean, we're there to... If somebody, you know, wants to kind of go down that road and they want to look into it, then... We love working with them, but I mean, we're not kind of tracking people down and saying, hey, you need to start
doing
your stats or whatever. You know.
Have you let Harrington into your office?
Harrington, we worked on him a little bit at the Ryder Cup.
Oh, yeah?
So, yeah,
he was impressed?
Hopefully, yeah. Yeah, he was very good. No, we were impressed by him, to be fair. I was just going to say,
what did he teach you?
we were impressed by all the captains, or the vice-captains, because they were very knowledgeable in the questions that they asked and how they went about using the information. You know, it's very easy to kind of say, oh, well, my opinion is the kind of way to go. But they were all very like, look, let's merge the two things. Let's merge the kind of the stats and the feel. And they used it very well.
Statistically, who's the best player in the world? That's fine.
Best player in the world, Justin Rose.
Okay, so that ties in with who's number one. And is tied statistically as the world number one rankings at the moment suggest? Is there nothing between Rose and the guy who's 10th, or is he?
It is tight. It doesn't tie in exactly with the world rankings. We have our own rankings.
Yeah. What's your top five?
It's Rose. Who is it? Who's second? Rose. You put me on the spot there.
Yeah.
Rose. Kepka's fifth. I know that. Fowler's fourth, actually.
Is he?
Yeah. Second, I think, is JT.
Dustin Johnson in there?
Sorry, yeah, DJ. Yeah, so it's Rose, DJ, JT, Fowler, Kepka.
Okay. Do you know where Rory is off the top of your head?
I think he's like 8th or 90, similar to his ranking. Okay. Yeah, they don't, like, what we found is we have our rankings, and what we found is that the world rankings tend to trend towards our rankings.
They're a bit behind you guys.
Yeah.
You can't say that, I can. That's what trend towards means.
So does Fowler being 4th then suggest that he's underachieving? That there is... The part that you can't actually put down to statistics, that's where he's lacking.
Depends how you classify underachieving. Like, he's playing really good golf, and that's kind of the... Like, if you look at Kepka and Fowler as a kind of match-up that Kepka has won 2 majors, you know, so this year. So that's why he's ranked so highly in the world. And to a point, it's very fair to say he is the best player in the world. But... We look at more kind of long-term performance rather than results. And that's kind of, that's a lot of what we do with a lot of players, is that we look at the underlying performance. We really want to, you know, tell them how well they're actually playing rather than the results, you know. So it depends how you define underachieving or performance or whatever. But.
What is the best round of golf that has been played since you started covering statistics?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I want that for next week.
I know they're about, that's another thing we do. So we look at like the strokes gained, strokes gained total for a round. So that'll be like their score relative to the field average. I think Tommy Fleetwood's round at the US Open.
63.
Yeah,
I think
that was up there. That's definitely one of the best in the last couple of years.
Did you guys know Molinari was going to win the Open?
No.
Really?
Well, like, I mean, we...
Did you have him in the top five, like, as a big contender? Not really.
Yeah, I think we did, yeah. Okay. Yeah, we had him up there, yeah. He was definitely going to be contending.
Dylan, we're going to have to become fast friends.
Yeah. So, we're going to have a little WhatsApp group.
Yeah, Dylan. You're now in the Golf Weekly WhatsApp group. Is there anything amateurs can take from what you've learned statistically? Like, you know, it's very interesting. It's drive for dough now is now what I'm going to be telling people.
Yeah.
I guess no one would bother to really measure rank bad amateurs in the same kind of depth as professionals, but is there anything you've learned statistically that amateurs can take to how they're practicing or what they're focusing on, or if they're going to get in a bad mood with every aspect of their game, what's not as important?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is what's a good shot and what's not a good shot. Like, I mean, if you look at, like I said, from 150 yards, if Rory McIlroy puts it to 20 feet, that's a pretty good shot for him.
Is it?
Yeah. So,
jeez. If I mean, 150 yards or 120 yards, if I was playing very well and put it to 20 feet, I wouldn't think that much of it.
Exactly, yeah. Well, that's a big thing. And I've found that since I've kind of really started looking in depth, that it's knowing what a good shot is. And your short game as well. If you're, say, 20 yards away and you put it to 4 feet, you might be going, oh, it's not great, but it's actually quite a good shot.
Right.
You know, so you kind of shouldn't beat yourself up about it.
So amateurs from the fairway are probably expecting a bit much from themselves.
Just hit the green. Yeah.
Hit the green's a good shot.
Pretty much, yeah.
Even for a single finger handicap player, that's a pretty good shot.
Yeah, well, if you think about it, like if you can put yourself on the green 12 times in a round in regulation, then you're going to shoot a pretty good score.
Which suggests that the biggest gap between the amateur and the professional is the driving distance.
It depends. Right. For me, well, like...
That's the thing that amazes me most when I go to a tournament. Like, well, you know, they're playing a different sport, obviously, right through from tee to green. But the thing that's just like untouchable, unreachable, is not some of the chips around or some of the putts or even some of the shots from 130, 40 yards, even though they hit them in such a different way, I know, but I'm just talking results. The thing that looks like, well, that's just not human, to my eye, is the driving. Like, I don't play with anyone who can do anything close to that.
Yeah, I mean, I play with some, like, low handicappers and they wouldn't be that far behind.
Really?
And again, it's, you know, a lot of it is to do with the environment. Like, if you put... Say if you take a scratch player from somewhere in Dublin, put them out on a perfect course, perfect conditions out in the US.
Hot weather.
They're probably going to average like 270, 280, which is only like 15, 20 yards behind a normal, you know, normal PGA
Pro. So our crappy cold air makes our drives look particularly bad.
It's an element of it. But there's also like, I think for me, the accuracy of amateurs is probably a big thing. Like hitting the fairway, you know, it's all very well hitting at 260 yards, but you have to put it in the fairway.
Yeah.
You know, these guys are hitting the fairways 60% of the time, and we're hitting to wider fairways, and we're probably not hitting that.
Would amateurs be better off hitting three woods or two or three irons a bit more?
If they can, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So finding the fairway at 230 on a cold winter's day is much better than driving a 250 as an amateur.
Yeah, I mean, the dynamic for amateurs is different because... That kind of contradicts a little bit what I said earlier on, but the dynamic for amateurs is different because at the top level, driving distance is hugely important, but yeah. For amateurs, it is more about hitting the fairway, hitting the greens,
right,
and keeping yourself in contention. But again, it really depends on what level you're at. Like, sure. I see a lot of, say, 12 handicappers who, you know, they'll hit the driver every time. And if you think about, if you go back to strokes gained, if you put one out of bounds, you're losing two strokes in that.
Yeah.
Whereas if you could, you know, if you put one in 10 out of bounds, you're losing two strokes. But if you can put three woods to 30 yards shorter,
yes,
10 times out of 10, then you're actually gaining more strokes overall.
That's fascinating. Because I'm a 12 handicapper. So I'm right. Like, I'm that guy who probably doesn't manage his game to his ability very well.
Yeah. Well, that's an example of it, yeah. But there's a lot of different things. And I mean, that's how I would kind of look. I mean, I'm probably an outlier in that sense, but that's how I'd manage my game, where if I'm on a tee,
What are you playing off?
Six. But okay. I kind of say, what's the percentage chance of me going out of bounds here? And if it's above kind of a certain percentage, I'll say, look, well, I'll take less club. And how far can I afford to come back here without losing strokes?
Right, interesting.
And it sounds like if you're on a tee, you're going to be sitting there with like 5 minutes, you know.
No,
but it's not as complicated.
It sounds like you're the type, and I have one or two mates, good mates who I play with a bit, and we would slag them for being conservative. And they're generally the smarter people in the group. They're strategic. They're you know, thinking about these things. But you're like, oh, I hit the driver, for God's sake.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there is times to do that as well. Like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you'd be, your mate would be slagging you for not hitting the driver plenty.
Occasionally, yeah. Yeah.
Well, actually, I think you'll find there was a 72% chance of me hitting the fairway here, and you've got a 38% chance.
Yeah.
Use
yeah.
a chump now.
Dylan is great crack to play golf.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's probably one of the main things for amateurs, I think.
No, it's very interesting. Okay, yeah. That's a good little tip, actually. So find the fairway at all costs and go from there, maybe.
Yeah, to a point.
To
yeah.
a point.
Yeah.
You got it. You can't. You
not
can't
a pitch,
don't hit a 9-iron.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Okay. Great. Listen, thanks so much for coming in. That was fascinating. I'm sure there'll be tweets and questions in, so we might catch up with you again in a couple of months' time. But Dylan Byrne from the 15th Club, thanks a million for being in here.
Thanks for having me.
We're pretty much done.
I think we are.
Okay, that's Golf Weekly for this week. We'll talk to you next week.
All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all picket down. Little JD starter kit right here.